This is a recording of Gamma Mark's recent works relevant to their study by Janet Ewell, published in Interpreter, a Journal of Latter-day Saint Faith and Scholarship, read by Janet Ewell. Gamma Mark's recent works relevant to their study by Janet Ewell. Abstract. Many are familiar with the so-called Gamma Marks, as they are portrayed on early medieval mosaics in Ravenna and Rome. They appear as right-angle marks, usually with toothed ends, or in a shape like a capital H, on the corners of angels' or worthies' robes, or in mosaics depicting textiles, such as altar cloths and hangings. The marks defy easy explanation, in part because they are also portrayed in multiple cultural contexts, well beyond Italy, and because they take other forms. This paper surveys publications from Maciej Szymaszek, one of three scholars whose recent works significantly increase our knowledge of the marks' geographic spread, their frequency of use, and their persistence across time. Several significant works related to gamma marks, or gammadia, have been published in the last dozen years. These works expand our knowledge of their range and frequency in late antiquity and the early medieval period, and offer hints concerning their significance to some who viewed or wore them. Maciej Szymaszek cataloged and studied 1st to 3rd century textile remnants with notched bands that bear these marks. Christina Cumbo photographed and documented more than 200 instances of the marks portrayed on the edges of worthies' mantles in the frescoes of the Roman catacombs. In addition, Yelena Bogdanovich wrote in 2014 about the liturgical context and the ritual and spatial significance of a 15th century priestly vestment, the sakos of Photios, the metropolitan of Kiev and all Rus. The sakos' opulent decorations were applied in the form of four crosses, each surrounded by sets of four right angles or gamma marks. These recent scholarly works enrich our knowledge of the marks' range and frequency and offer insight into their possible significance. To use comparative religion's vocabulary, these papers, taken together, suggest that the marks sometimes delineated sacred spaces and may, in some cases, have been associated with rituals, including rites of passage. In this study, I share images of what are frequently considered to be gamma marks and discuss Szymaszek's doctoral work on the 1st to 3rd century textile remnants that bear these marks. Using Szymaszek's work, archaeological reports, and the ensuing scholarly analysis, the paper suggests patterns that seem to emerge and looks at the pattern's implication. The primary evidence of gamma marks is visual, not verbal. Therefore, it is much easier to point to a gamma mark than it is to define one. Please see figures 5 through 23 for examples of gamma marks. Gamma marks on preserved textiles, Maciej Szymaszek's work. Maciej Szymaszek's 2014 unpublished doctoral dissertation examines over 160 textiles with woven-in notched bands from the 1st to 3rd century from more than 20 sites in the Roman Empire of the time. Many were previously unpublished. The bands were most often tapestry woven into woolen cloth with colored wool threads that contrasted with the larger textiles. The tapestry woven bands were red, yellow, blue, black, or purple. Of the more than 160 textiles, 54% were sufficiently well preserved to allow Szymaszek to identify the marks' original forms. These fell into three shapes. Among these textiles with identifiable shapes, shape 1, a right angle, the so-called gamma shape, referring to the Greek capital gamma, is the most common, with about 58 examples, 36%, found at 16 sites. Shape 2, like a capital H, the so-called eta shape, referring to the capital Greek eta, is less common, with roughly 24 examples, 15%, found in 8 sites, while there are 8 examples of shape 3, which were woven with a checkerboard pattern made from 5 squares. 8 of these, 4%, were found at 4 sites. Multiple sites produced both textiles with right-angle gamma marks and textiles with eta-shaped marks. Though most of the textile remains are small, handkerchief size, a few are considerably larger. The larger textiles indicate the marks could appear near the corners of rectangular fabric that had been woven to shape. Shamashik refers to these as mantles. One remarkably intact textile from the Sudan measures more than 7.5 feet long and 4.5 feet wide. Shamashik also writes that smaller remnants could have come from veils or tunics based on the gamma shape's artistic representation from the period, including from mummy masks and mosaics portraying bands with notched ends. The textiles were found principally in Egypt, Sudan, and Syria, where the dry climate favors textile preservation, but they were also found across a wider geographic range, including in Vindolanda, a Roman fort in England, just south from Hadrian's Wall, in a burial in central France, and in Israel, Jordan, and At-Tar in modern Iraq. The Middle East's dry climates aid in textile preservation, while the textiles from Vindolanda were preserved when the 97 CE Roman fort was razed to make way for the 104 CE fort, with the old fort's remains covered by a layer of turf or clay to provide a clean area for the new structure. The resulting anaerobic conditions preserved virtually all the Roman debris. At Les Matres de Verre, textiles from the burial in central France were preserved by the presence of carbolic acid, which permeates the region and acts against bacterial or biological degradation. Shamashik has more recently facilitated the radiocarbon dating of 11 other well-preserved tapestry-woven textile fragments with notched bands from burials that were rescued before the flooding by the Aswan Dam in Upper Egypt and neighboring countries in 1960. The oldest dates from as early as 130 CE, the most recent from as late as 540 CE. As with the first to third century textiles studied in his doctoral work, several textiles appear to have been originally rectangular, with woven-in bands forming right angles, or H-shaped motifs, near the corners. 7 of the 11 were clearly in a right-angle shape, and 2 were clearly in the H or eta shape. Shamashik writes that the marks serve no structural function, such as reinforcing the cloth. He also writes that these mantles may have served as a decorative motif and cautions that, at the current state of research, it cannot be confirmed that the signs conveyed a symbolic or religious meaning. He also notes that the widespread occurrence of textile artifacts bearing the same two shapes, the right angle and the H shape, have been repeated in the same way for more than 500 years. He eschews discussion of the textile owners' ethnic or religious identities. The textiles' find spots, that is, the physical location where they were recovered, are often complex. His study does, nonetheless, enlarge our views concerning who might have worn or used such textiles. Though artistic and monumental presentations show these marked mantles generally on people with elite status or high prestige, predominantly male, the woven artifacts confirm that they are worn by both genders and at least sometimes by non-elites. His work documents the marked mantles used by people from many social classes, including miners, quarry workers, soldiers, and Jews under siege at Masada and at the Cave of Letters. The artifacts he catalogues show that they generally seem to be domestically produced textiles, rather than imported or luxury goods. He also documents more than 360 images of these marks from late antiquity that show correlation between the textile artifacts and the artistic representation, noting Egyptian mummy portraits, Palmyrean sculpture, Jewish mosaics, catacomb paintings, and Christian manuscripts, as well as mosaics and frescoes in public and religious buildings. He writes, "Bands depicted in art closely correspond in shape, color, and position to those seen on archaeological finds from the 1st to the 3rd century CE. Of these more than 360 ancient artistic representations, 85% come from Christian contexts, while 15% are associated with Jewish, Egyptian, Palmyrene, Roman, and Greek contexts. These numerous representations in art demonstrate that textiles with the signs have also been known in regions where archaeological evidence is not preserved due to conditions unfavorable for fabric survival." Previous publications concerning these gamma marks have focused on the marks' artistic representations, which were likely commissioned by those with at least some financial means. These artistic representations have informed, and perhaps skewed, scholars' interpretations. The textile remains Shamashic studied are primary evidence, while the paintings and mosaics are secondary representations, or perhaps tertiary evidence if artists and craftsmen worked from copybooks or other representations. 7 of the 22 find spots Shamashic documents are discussed below, chosen here for the quantity of the information available about the find spots and their contexts, for their geographic spread, and for their capacity to add information about the textiles, owners, and uses. They also illustrate the difficulties scholars face when trying to identify textiles' owners or when trying to discern what the textile meant to its owners. Textiles from Le Martre de Vere. The 2nd century woman's burial from Le Martre de Vere in central France, about 110 miles west from Lyon, reveals her gender and that she was buried in a wooden coffin with a woolen tabby-woven textile bearing a woven-in, right-angle, denticulated gamma mark that spanned roughly 6 inches on the cloth. The researchers who studied this and other Gallo-Roman textiles from across France concluded the available data are inadequate to risk cultural attribution and to separate what stems from the Gaelic tradition, the Roman contribution, or imports. France includes a part of the Gallia Comata conquered by Caesar and the Provincia, Roman for a long time but under the influence of early Greek settlement and heir to a long tradition of Mediterranean exchange. Obscure though the burial may be, it does contribute at least one important idea. A 2nd century female burial could include a mantle with a right angle shaped mark. Textiles from Vindolanda. The gamma-marked textile was deposited between 97 and 104 CE in a frontier wooden Roman fort a mile south from where Hadrian's Wall would later be built, now in northern England. The fort, which was adjacent to ironstone and leadworking, and at that time contained daub and wattle buildings, housed the 9th cohort of Batavians from present-day Holland, fewer than 500 men. This early fort enclosed only a few acres. The textile with a gamma mark was one of the nicer ones found among those discarded in the area of the Praetorium, where the fort's leadership and their families would have lived. The woolen textile was woven in a fine half-basket weave with a tapestry-woven notched gamma inserted into it in a full-basket weave, but with innumerable faults. J.P. Wild writes, "It began life as a cloak, was carefully remodeled for another unknown textile function, perhaps after a tertiary use, was jettisoned with many other rags in room 12 of the Praetorium. It may have belonged to the prefect Flavius Cerealis, or his literate wife, Sulpicia Lepidina, but no textiles found there were imported Eastern exotica. While the prefect and his wife had prestige and were educated people in this frontier Roman fort, it would be hard to argue that anyone there enjoyed exalted status. Textiles from the Cave of Letters. The remains from 5 to 8 woolen mantles with notched bands were found in burial niches in the Cave of Letters, 5 kilometers west from Ein Gedi in the Judean desert, where Jews who were definitely supporters of Bar Kokhba in his struggles against Rome, 132 to 135 CE, diligently adhered to the various halakhot contained in Talmudic literature of the period. They were members of families that had fled the rebellion in Ein Gedi and were pinned in the cave by Roman soldiers camped above them, who cut them off from both escape and from the only water source in the region. Only one mantle is well enough preserved to indicate its size, 8.9 feet by 4.6 feet, large enough to be used as a blanket or bed covers, and woven to shape on a very broad loom. Yigael Yadin, who excavated the site, compares the mantle's shape and size to the dimensions of a Roman woman's pallium, where the measure from the floor to the base of the neck was equal to the cloth's width. Its length, which was to be wrapped around the body, was 2 1/6 time the width. The gamma marks appear near the mantle's corners. The gamma-bearing mantles were colorful compared to other textiles from the cave, and Yadin originally identified them as women's items based on the frescoes in the synagogue at Dura Europus. They were dyed reddish-brown from madder or blue-black from madder, indigo, and saffron. One fragment with gamma marks had a blue thread wrapped around the loose warp end, suggesting the presence of tzitzits, tassels, on the corners of at least one of the gamma-marked mantles. The tzitzits suggest that the mantles may have served as a talit gadol, a prayer shawl. A talit gadol may also serve as a shroud. Yadin notes that the mantles found in the burial niches had no traces of tzitzits. He writes, "I do not believe this is accidental, for it was evidently customary to remove the tzitzits from mantles of persons being buried." Yadin also reports unattached, unspun wool in bundles, tied in the middle with linen thread and dyed by dipping the tufts in blue or double-dyed in madder and indigo, as Arit Shamir suggests, presumably for tzitzits. Shamir adds that they were found in a letter skin wrapped in a piece of woolen mantle decorated with the H-shaped design and a linen cloth. The belongings left in the cave indicate a level of prosperity among the people from Ein Gedi. A cache of bronze vessels was found hidden in Hall A. Hall C yielded 3 glass vessels that had been neatly wrapped and carefully hidden away. Their exceptional packing would indicate that their owners had attached special importance to them, and there is little doubt that they had been packed in Ein Gedi prior to flight to the cave. Keys, all iron, left in the cave indicated that the refugees possessed locked chests for jewelry and other precious possessions. They also had keys to what were probably doors, some very thick and heavy doors, such as those of a courtyard or fort. The papers of Babeta, found in a water skin in the cave, indicated that she owned date orchards inherited from her first husband and was wealthy enough to loan money to her polygynous second husband. Nothing in the cave, however, indicates exalted status. Textiles from Kirbet Ka'azon Cemetery. Excavation in this 1st to 3rd century burial site, southeast from the Dead Sea, now in Jordan, recovered 57 identifiable textile garments, including parts of 5 mantles. 2 have gamma marks at the corners, a red one which was large enough to be worn around the body and over a woman's head and shoulders as a veil, as shown in the Dura Europa Synagogue frescoes, preserves part of at least two of the four gamma motifs that originally decorated it, with projections or spurs at the corner of the gammas. It was at least 2 meters wide, one relatively small textile, 49 inches by less than 92 inches, perhaps for a child, was coarser, undyed wool, and had four simple squares in the gamma or eta shapes places. Textiles were found scattered on the surface and in looted graves in the cemetery, which was estimated to hold 3,500 graves. Constantine D. Politis excavated 23 previously intact interments. Some bodies were buried in leather shrouds, but others in reused textiles, usually in a simple tabby weave. Most textiles at the site appear to be clothing, repurposed as shrouds. Politis wrote, "Most textiles are characteristic sleeveless Roman tunics with purple-colored stripe or rectangular Greek mantles decorated with four symmetrically placed colored motifs, usually gamma-shaped." He writes, "As exciting and rare as these finds may be, they do not characterize a specific ethnic group, nor can they be attributed to a particular religious affiliation. They simply reflect the popular clothing styles of the period." He writes that the majority of the burials were Nabataean, that Greek appeared on stelae and papyri from the site, and that no evidence of Aramaic or Hebrew texts or symbols indicate the presence of Jews at the site. However, Hero Granger Taylor wrote, "It is likely that a portion of the population was Jewish, since we know from the Babetta documents from the Cave of Letters that there were Jews living in the area. There were no luxury grave goods. A few burials contained grave goods such as iron, copper, silver, or gold earrings and bracelets." Granger Taylor writes, "Judging by their clothes, these people were not impoverished, but nor were they wealthy." Politis mentions the peaceful coexistence between Jews and Nabataeans in the area surrounding the harbors at the Dead Sea's south end, which led to various intercommunal influences, among which apparently were shaft burials. Even intermarriage between the two groups at the highest level was acceptable, including King Herod the Great, whose father was Jewish and his mother was Nabataean. Excavation at Kirbet Khoazon reveals multiple mantles with gamma marks coming from relatively humble burials and demonstrate how complex it can be to determine who wore them and why. Textiles from Masada. One clearly gamma-marked textile and two possibly gamma-marked textiles were found among the roughly 2,000 textiles recovered from the hilltop fortress Masada, built on a high plateau in the Judean desert to the west of the Dead Sea. According to Josephus, 960 people chose death over surrender when Romans laid siege, built a ramp, and then breached the wall with a battering ram. Only 122 textile items, or 6% of the 2,000-plus textiles, have been examined and published, with others awaiting study and publication. Among the 122 published was a large mantle with a gamma motif, probably from a man's draped mantle or tallit, a prayer shawl. The textile remnant is 32 by 40 centimeters. Two smaller fragments may bear gamma marks but are too small to say conclusively. One is a right angle shape that lacks the characteristic teeth protruding from the ends. The entire textile is about 10 by 14 centimeters, with the tapestry-woven mark filling only a small edge section. Avigail Scheffer and Hero Taylor Granger write it may have been a baby tunic. It is undyed wool with the marked tapestry woven into it. The third is a salmon pink wool with part of a notched band and a second band in bright purple, tapestry woven into it. It is also small, 17 by 6.5 centimeters. We have some information about the people at Masada who might have worn gamma-marked textiles. They were almost certainly Jews, but their more specific affiliations are hard to determine. The Roman garrison there was overcome in 66 CE by people Josephus identifies as Sicarii, or dagger men. He indicates the people holed up in Masada were urban from Jerusalem and espoused religious beliefs and national aspirations that provoked them to murder in broad daylight in the heart of the city. There sprang up another sort of robber in Jerusalem, which were called Sicarii, who slew men in the daytime and in the midst of the city. This they did chiefly at the festivals, when they mingled themselves among the multitude and concealed daggers under their garments, with which they stabbed those that were their enemies. And when any fell down dead, the murderers became a part of those that had indignation against them, by which means they appeared persons of such reputation that they could by no means be discovered. The first man who was slain by them was Jonathan, the high priest, after whose death many were slain every day. After the temple's destruction in 70 CE, more people fled from across Israel, particularly from Jerusalem, to Masada. The Masada textiles provenance is further complicated because, Josephus writes, the Sicarii plundered all the villages around the fortress. Textiles may have come from the plunder. These often urban Jews had a wider range and better quality textiles generally than did their neighbors 60 years later, the people of Ein Gedi who died at the Cave of Letters. Schaefer and Granger Taylor write, "The dominant impression given by the textiles at Masada is of a wealthy community fallen on hard times, who previously, at least, had been wealthy and well-connected, but who were forced to mend, alter, and repurpose relatively good quality textiles." Josephus does not identify anyone with exalted status at Masada. Textiles from Al-Bagawat Cemetery, Kharga Oasis, Egypt. Textiles from Al-Bagawat Cemetery at Egypt's Kharga Oasis provide the strongest archaeological evidence for Christian use of gamma-marked textiles. The cemetery served Ibis, the great oasis capital, which sat on important trade routes, a 4 or 5 day camel journey west from Thebes in the Nile Valley. 31 gamma-marked textiles were found during the Metropolitan Museum of New York's Egyptian Expeditions, 1907 to 1930. Attributing textiles to one group in Egypt is challenging. Though Egypt and its neighbors have a rich history of both Christianity and gamma-marked textiles, proof that one group used a particular textile is rare. Sometimes inscriptions, grave goods, and markings, such as a cross or an ach, are so closely associated with burial textiles that it is possible to say with certainty that the person buried with the textiles, or at least their immediate family, belong to a particular group. More often, such certainty, especially in Egypt, is elusive. 1. Burial practices and dress in Egypt are rarely unique to one group, so identification from such physical remains alone is problematic. Roman, Greek, Nabataean, Arabic, Muslim, pre-Christian, Meroitic, Jewish, and Coptic populations all lived in Egypt in the first millennium, and populations appear to have overlapped in time and place. 2. Several groups who have left evidence elsewhere that they used gamma-marked textiles, including Jews and Nabataeans, lived or traded in Egypt. If only a small number of gamma-marked textiles are identified as coming from an Egyptian find spot, we have not shown that the larger population used or even worn them. Textiles that combined linen and wool were probably not worn by Jews, except priests. 3. The antiquities trade in recent centuries often obliterated textiles' provenances, thwarting their owners' identification. In addition, during its infancy, modern archaeology also excavated textiles, but did not document or conserve them systematically. For synchronism may have been at play. Cultures borrowed each other's manner of dress and burial practices. Families as well as communities may have included mixed traditions in what appear to be contemporaneous family groupings in Egypt and elsewhere that include burials that align with more than one ethnicity or religious tradition. 5. Graves may have been plundered with their less valuable contents dumped in surface pits. Graves may also have been reused for later burials long before archaeologists arrived. Al-Bagawat Cemetery shares these complexities with other Egyptian burial sites and middens. Though sometimes referred to as a Christian cemetery, the earliest burials at Al-Bagawat show no sign of a Christian presence. The continued presence of pagan burials alongside Christian interments is evident in Egypt up until the Arab conquest in the 7th century. Pagans and Christians were known to have lived side by side at Al-Bagawat. Al-Bagawat provides a strong case for associating Christians and gamma marks. The Al-Bagawat Cemetery has characteristics that, taken together, increase the likelihood that Christian burials there yielded the gamma-marked textiles. First, written records show that the Karga Oasis had a significant Christian population from at least 250 CE, a population large enough for the Patriarch of Alexandria to appoint a bishop for the area. Second, its remoteness spared it some of the 19th century archaeologists' irregularities. Though known in the West in the early 19th century, it was not investigated until the early 20th century by the Egyptian expedition from the Metropolitan Museum of New York, which studied it sporadically between 1907 and 1931. The later Egyptian Antiquities Service's investigation provided the first published archaeological report in 1951. Third, and archaeologically significant, the cemetery includes over 260 mud brick funerary chapels arranged into streets, as are known from Rome and Byzantine Italy, and best exemplified by the Isola Sacra Cemetery, north of Ostia. 22 chapels at Al-Bagawat were decorated with Christian symbols and painted scenes. 7 contain figurative art, the others evidencing just painted crosses and the like. 2 chapels have extensive and well-preserved painted decorations that show a Christian context and are similar in style to paintings at the Apa Jeremiah and Apa Apollo monasteries. Christian worthies portrayed in Al-Bagawat's chapels include Noah, Abraham, Thecla, and Mary, each identified anciently in Coptic. Burials, and therefore their textiles, are closely associated with the funerary chapels in shallow rectangular graves around the mud brick chapels or beneath them, sometimes in multiple chambers in subterranean hypogea accessed with vertical shafts. The most skillfully decorated chapel at Al-Bagawat, the Chapel of Peace, shows 2 worthies wearing gamma-marked mantles, Noah and Abraham, painted inside the chapel's dome. The clothing portrayed on worthies in the chapel frescoes and the cloths in which the associated dead were shrouded bore similar gamma marks, also placed near the textiles' edges. They strongly suggest that not only were Christian worthies clothed in gamma-bedecked mantles, but so were the Christian dead. The Metropolitan Museum of New York's Egyptian expedition retrieved 33 bodies, 2 male and 8 female adults, and 9 infants were identifiable, and preserved 97 textile fragments from Al-Bagawat. 31 textiles were from linen burial shrouds without pre-burial use. They had been specifically woven as shrouds. 2 of the 31 have woven in right angle gamma marks. 15 have the eta shape, another 9 have solid circles, 2 have crux gammata, crosses made from gamma marks, that is, a swastika. 2 have diamond shapes. They are dated from the mid-3rd through the early 5th century. Some combine wool and linen. 1 remarkably complete shroud is almost 11 and a half feet long and over a yard wide. All shrouds have slits or have been divided near their ends to facilitate the neat wrapping of bodies. Al-Bagawat shows that Christians, both male and female, use textiles bearing these marks in death, and that such textiles and marks were appropriate for the general population's burials, as well as appropriate for Abraham and Noah, as they were portrayed in the dome fresco of the Chapel of Peace. Textiles from the Dura Europas Synagogue. The 1932 excavation at the Dura Europas Synagogue revealed extensive and well-preserved 3rd-century frescoes. Among the frescoes, which include many Old Testament scenes, were painted figures wearing mantles that display gamma marks, or at least the pronged ends of them. Dura Europas was a small garrison or trading city on the river Euphrates in modern Syria, then on the frontier between the Eastern Roman Empire and Persia. The entire city was destroyed during a Persian siege circa 256 CE. The site was buried in sand until the early 20th century. The excavating archaeologists also recovered 19 tapestry-woven wool fragments that displayed gamma marks, which may well have come from a sacred vestry. Though the textile remains are too small to indicate the original item's shape, R. Pfister and Louisa Bellinger, who compiled the textile report for the Yale University French excavation, wrote that on the evidence of the pictures in the synagogue, we may confidently class pieces with decorations in the shape of the eta and gamma as belonging to those garments, the mantles. The frescoes showed figures wearing mantles with either complete right-angle gamma marks on the Israelite women in the infancy of Moses panel, or what are thought to be the pronged end of an eta or gamma shape on the Israelite men, with the rest of the mark uniformly obscured in their mantles' folds. Some male mantles also showed 3 threads hanging from the mantle's corners that have usually been identified with the tzitzit, the ceremonial threads required by Jewish law for a prayer shawl, that is, a talit gadol, the covering from which a man could pray. The male figures portrayed wearing these gamma-marked mantles are frequently large, indicating their importance. Moses, Elijah, Jacob, Samuel, Ezekiel in his triumph, the heads of the tribes in the Exodus scene, and 5 more whose identity is disputed, as well as the throne mates, both of Solomon and the great king in the Reredos by the Torah niche, each wear a gamma-marked mantle. By the Torah niche, each wear a gamma-marked mantle. Their mantles are generally white, or almost always of a light color. Erwin R. Goodenough, who devoted the last 3 volumes of his 11-volume Jewish Symbols in the Greco-Roman Period to the Dura Europas Synagogue, wrote that on the synagogue's west wall, immediately to the Torah shrine's right, is the single exception to the light-colored mantles on a major Israelite character. In the Anointing of David fresco, Samuel's importance is shown by his large size. 6 other men are clad in marked robes like Samuel, all pastels or white, with 3 holding their right hands up to about their ear level. We cannot see if the other 3 are also holding up their hands. David is alone in wearing a dark robe. Goodenough writes that this has the appearance of a rite of initiation. As Samuel anoints David, David's mantle, conspicuously, has no visible gamma marks. Goodenough writes, "We shall find this contrast apparently significant. David's hands are hidden inside his dark mantle in the humble position of a supplicant, as one who has not completed an initiation. The scene suggests that David's anointing precedes his clothing in a white gamma-marked mantle, such as those other men wear." Goodenough writes, "If such a scene with no biblical identification had been found at Pompeii or Alexandria, we should at once have supposed the artist was representing the initiation of a neophyte into a mystic cult. His dark dress the humble covered hands would seem to illustrate the novitiate before he had received the new garment of the cult. The textile fragments buried in the embankment associated with the synagogue include 19 textiles with pronged ornaments, as well as ornate clothing. Goodenough writes, "It seems to me highly unlikely that the ordinary clothing at Dura was either white or ornamented in the way we see in the paintings or in the preserved textiles." He notes the gamma-marked fragment's whiteness. Much of the cloth had apparently not been dyed at all, but was what we call unbleached, and some of these may originally have been white, for pure whiteness, as any laundress knows, is extremely hard to preserve. Based on a contemporary price list from a 3rd-century textile trader at Dura, white garments were the most expensive, so we may presume that white was rarely worn. Goodenough also notes that many of them seem to have been rags when dumped into the embankment, but this in no way indicates that the place where they had been kept was a common or an ordinary one. It is quite possible that they represented a store of garments, especially pieces on which were sacral markings, from a ritualistic treasure. "But this can no more be asserted," he continues, "that they were ordinary rags. All the textile fragments tell us is that the ornaments shown on the painted costumes of the synagogue were used on costumes of some sort worn at Dura." What the textiles imply collectively and by fine spots. Taken as a group, the textile artifacts Shemashik studied add information to what was previously gleaned from the mark's occurrence in artistic, funerary, and monumental media. There they were predominantly associated with angels, worthies, or people of high spiritual status, most often male. Patterns seem to emerge from the information gleaned from the artifacts, patterns that may have implication for our understanding of the marks. The artifacts contribute the information that textiles marked with pronged ends were worn by non-elite, both male and female, over at least 400 years in the first millennium CE. They also show an impressively wide geographic range from northern Britain to Iraq and south to Sudan. These textile artifacts do not appear to be imported or luxury goods, rather locally or domestically produced. The textiles' geographic range suggests that they were also used in other areas where we find their representations, but where the climate did not favor textile preservation. Individual fine spots, or groups of fine spots, suggest additional insights. However, what a textile from one fine spot or several fine spots implies should not be hastily generalized to all locations and all wearers or users of such textiles. All that can be confidently asserted is that, to some people, at certain places, the marks may have functioned in a particular way. Nonetheless, these data and insights deserve notice, and when patterns are suggested, they also should be noted. The evidence for local production and for the marked mantle's persistent characteristics. At least 3 widely separated fine spots, Vindolanda, Le Marteau de Verre, and Kirbet Croazon, attest to local or domestic production. From 1st or 2nd century Vindolanda, we learn that a mantle was woven by a less-than-expert weaver into a fine half-basket weave with innumerable faults. From 2nd century Le Marteau de Verre, we learn the woolen was tabby-woven, the most basic weaving pattern. At 1st to 3rd century Kirbet Croazon, the marks appear in coarse, undyed wool. These imply the gamma-marked mantles weavers were not highly skilled and were probably domestic or local weavers. Yet a tapestry-woven gamma or eta shape inserted into a mantle in a contrasting color requires resources. Wool dyed a second color, usually in a heavier yarn, to cover the background wool's color. The weaving in of such marks was not a slight skill for a domestic weaver in the 1st 3 or 4 centuries CE, and required additional time and effort. This raises questions about how and why the weaving tradition, if that is what it was transmitted with consistency across centuries and across distances. On monumental art and in artistic media, the mark's persistence may be explained in at least two ways. Powerful patrons, their architects, designers, or craftspeople may have traveled and thus viewed other works displaying such marks, perhaps studying with the masters who had previously reproduced them. Additionally, artisans may have worked from copybooks or other intermediate media, but neither method for transmitting the design seemed to apply to local weavers who would rarely travel or see copybooks. Other transmission methods should be considered to explain the mark's consistency. An admittedly incomplete answer is that the weavers in each community carefully copied existing local textiles for centuries and across thousands of miles. This explanation, however, raises additional questions. What motivated domestic weavers to continue to include the marks? Why were they copied with such consistency? The mark's persistence implies their form carried meaning across multiple transmission chains. Absent other compelling explanations, rituals, which can be highly conservative over both time and space, should be considered as a factor in the mark's spread. The evidence for the marks and the mantle's use in burials. From Al-Bagawat, we learn that the marked mantles, at least at that fine spot, were appropriate for burials, since the shrouds showed no sign of previous use. All have slits near their ends, so they would not have been useful to the living. At other sites, Le Martre de Verre, Hubert Croazon, and the Cave of Letters, it could be argued that gamma mark textiles were used as shrouds because they were at hand, not because they were specifically appropriate for burial. Though if the mantles at the Cave of Letters were indeed talitot, prayer shawls, then their use in burials might be expected. But at Al-Bagawat, wrapping the dead in a new gamma-marked mantle was a common preparation for internment, the ultimate earthly rite of passage. These burial textiles combine with multiple instances of the marks shown in funerary contexts, grave markers, tombs, mummy masks, and memorials. Together they suggest the marks and the mantles had, at least to some, specific relevance to burial and the transition that death and burial imply. The presence of the marks on shrouds adds weight to Goodenough's comments about the mantle's frequent appearance in funerary art, even as other attire is portrayed elsewhere on the living and the divine. He is not discussing gamma marks specifically, only draped mantles. He uses the Greek word for a mantle, himation. He asks whether a person depicted is wearing his ordinary clothes or specially recognized holy garb. He notes that more than half of the people portrayed in mummy masks were wearing an himation, presumably with the himation's end wrapped around the woman's heads, as at the Dura synagogue. The mantles appeared on memorial statues and were carved in stone and wooden funerary couches, as grave reliefs and tomb paintings, and on grave stelae. He writes, "The use of the robe has led us too often to monuments of ritualistic dignity, if not to mystical or eschatological associations, or to the gods themselves, for us to suppose that this dress was ever used casually or merely to correspond to what we might call formal dress." Speaking of mummy masks, Goodenough writes that the dead are dressed to come into God's presence. It is also possible that the marks added to the shrouds were meant to provide protection to the Karga Oasis Christian dead as they encountered whatever challenges awaited them in the afterlife. If so, they may have also been used to provide protection for the living who wore them. Archaeological evidence is unable to distinguish between what might be an apotropaic device, such as the evil eye, and what might be the evidence of deeply held religious beliefs. The evidence for tzitzit associated with gamma marks. The blue threads on the corner of a gamma-marked mantle in the Cave of Letters shows that, at least at that site, gamma marks were sometimes used on a tzitzit gadol. a large prayer shawl, which made the little tent from which a Jew could pray. The apparent tzitzits painted on gamma-marked mantles on the Dura synagogue's walls add additional instances where tzitzits and gamma marks both frame the mantle's edge and may have set apart sacred space. Gamma marks on textiles supplement previous insights gained from the 15th century Liber Pontificalis, the Book of Popes. The textile artifacts with marks also support their artistic representations on book covers, altar cloths, and clerical robes, as well as ossuaries and the images of doors of a 5th century Jewish tomb with gamma marks. In each case, they may delineate sacred spaces, setting boundaries between levels of sacredness or between the sacred and the profane, this world and the next. The evidence for multiple Jewish users of gamma-marked textiles at 3 sites across 2 centuries. Gamma-marked textiles found at 1st century Masada, the 2nd century Cave of Letters, and the 3rd century Dura show that the marked textiles' use endured for several centuries in Jewish contexts. It also suggests, at least in the matter of gamma-marked textiles, the Jews at Dura were not outliers. They shared attire with Jews at Masada and at the Cave of Letters, notably Jews who have strong credentials as resistors to compromise, whatever questions scholars may have had about Dura's Jews. These textile artifacts, combined with other evidence from mosaics and funerary art, largely discovered since Dura's excavation, to show the marks' continuing use among Jews from the 1st to the 5th century. The mosaic floor at a Jerusalem high priestly house destroyed in 70 CE. The mosaic floor at the Magdala synagogue in Galilee destroyed in 67 CE, or perhaps in the 2nd century. The Ada-shaped gamma marks on Jewish worthies' robes in mosaics in the 5th century synagogue at Hukkah and the rough-cut stone door to a 5th century Jewish tomb at Tamara and on Jewish ossuaries. The Dura synagogue sits chronologically roughly in the middle of these occurrences of gamma marks. The gamma's persistence in the land of Israel shows that the gamma-marked mantles at Dura were not necessarily borrowed from local pagan usage, nor can we say that the Syrian Jews were casual about their religion because the marks and mantles appeared on their synagogue's walls. The gamma-marked textiles at Dura did not show that the Jews were at odds with their co-religionists in Palestine, at least in this matter. Though the marks appeared with some frequency, except at Dura, no evidence links the Jewish gamma-marked textiles to initiation rites, with the possible exception of the remains of the blue thread identified as tzitzit from the Cave of Letters. We can only say that at one spot, Dura, the textiles and initiation rite appear linked. However, it would seem strange if Jews alone in late antiquity eschewed initiation rites. Such rites were a staple across the Mediterranean. The cults of Mithras, Isis, Dionysus, Baal, Artagastus, and Seropsis were highly participatory and apparently involved initiation rites. Adult Christians during this era were washed, anointed, ritually bathed in immersion baptism, and clothed in new white garments. Earlier Israelites practiced washing, anointing, and clothing, arguably for King David, but also for Aaron and his sons. A new Essene was given a robe of white upon his initiation. Carl H. Kraling, who wrote the reports for the entire Dura Europus excavation, including the synagogues, and good enough, saw at Dura a Judaism different from that memorialized in rabbinic sources, despite the Dura synagogue's considerable size and impressive frescoes, or perhaps because of the latter, the Dura synagogue did not meet either scholar's expectation. But the recently published evidence for gamma marks in multiple other Jewish contexts now makes it harder to dismiss the worshippers at Dura and their peculiar building as pagan or exhibiting a weak or lapsed Judaism. If it was not a poorly executed synagogue, what sort of a building was it? It was the excavators at Dura who identified it as a synagogue. The Aramaic inscriptions at the site call the entire building simply Bet, house. Where we are called upon to identify a newly discovered object, the vocabulary we use can either limit or expand the range of the object's potential meanings and functions. Kraling and Goodenough described the three spaces at the Dura Synagogue using the Greek and Latin vocabulary for pagan temples, temenos, pronoos, noos, kella, and edicule, noting similarities and differences between the Jewish building at Dura and known pagan temples. We do not know the names the worshippers at Dura used for the spaces in the synagogue. In English, the three spaces at Dura are often called, moving from east to west, the forecourt, the house of assembly, and the aedicule. The aedicule contained the Torah shrine, the house of the ark, according to a Dura inscription. Perhaps the two early scholars did not consider that the Hebrew terms ulam, hikal, and Debir were warranted at Dura, or perhaps they reserved them solely for the earlier Israelite sacred spaces, the tabernacle in the wilderness, and Solomon's and Herod's temples in Jerusalem, which were also oriented on an axis from east to west and surrounded by a sacred precinct, as were some pagan temples at Dura and elsewhere, and as was the Dura synagogue. If the Hebrew terms are also considered when describing the Dura synagogue, additional possible sources or allusions are available for consideration. Both Goodenough and Kraling note that the Dura synagogue's layout resembles not Palestinian synagogues, but some pagan temples. Neither scholar reports comparing its layout to Israelite sacred spaces. The main spaces in the synagogue at Dura were oriented in almost a straight line, with the entry, the lowest area, on the east, and the worship's focus and highest area, the aedicule, on the west. Goodenough writes that with the remodeling of an earlier synagogue, the Shekinah, or real presence, was brought to precisely this axis and put into a new little kodesh, the Aron HaKodesh, or Holy Ark, behind the curtains. Kraling notes that such axial organization resembles the domestic architecture of Mesopotamia, which in turn shares certain traits with temple architecture, apparently referencing pagan temples. He notes that the size of the House of Assembly is a monumental hall for which parallels exist at Dura only in pagan temples. The Dura synagogue's layout and axial orientation resembled not only some pagan temples, but also the earlier temples at Jerusalem, both of which were entered on the east, with the worshipper ascending to the west, the focus of the worship being at the far west end of the structure. Worshippers entered the Dura synagogue's compound through a door off a small private street to the compound's north, into what had once been a private home. They passed through a space created from domestic dwellings and used for the synagogue's practical matters, including a traveler's hostel and housing for personnel. Moving west through the former domestic rooms and up four steps, a half meter, the worshippers encountered the first space that was built on a grand scale, the forecourt, as Kraling called it, the temenos for Goodenough, and the ulam for Israelite temples. It was enclosed on four sides and was entered through a door or doors centered on the forecourt's eastern wall and across from the likewise centered and grand double doors into the House of Assembly further west. The forecourt was 43.6 feet wide and 33.6 feet deep and lined on three sides with tall, massive columns. Goodenough and Kraling write that the columns held up an ambulatory roof, implying the room was probably otherwise open to the sky. Both agree that the columns were tall, 14 feet, Kraling, or 20 feet, Goodenough. The forecourt had at least one laver. Evidence suggests from the earlier synagogue there supports the presence of an altar measuring a yard square. The House of Assembly, the pronaos for Kraling and Goodenough, sometimes the Kella for good enough, and the Hekal for Israelite temples, was a flat-roofed box with 14-foot-tall doors and 23-foot-high ceilings. It formed one of the largest single rooms of which we have knowledge at Dura, 45 feet wide and more than 25 feet from entry door to its western wall. It was lined with benches along all sides, as one would expect in a synagogue, but also decorated with extraordinary frescoes. In pagan temples, the statue or god's image would have been displayed as the ritual's focal point in this room. Whatever participatory rites the textiles from the sacred vestry imply probably took place in this room under the frescoes. But Dura displayed no cult statue or divine image, in contrast to pagan analogues. Worship was instead visually focused on the aedicule, which contained a niche built into the thickness of the wall, about 16 inches. It was the room's only architectural embellishment. For it to be appropriate to refer to the aedicule as the Hebrew word debir, the Holy of Holies, it would need to be seen as a separate architectural space, set apart by a higher elevation, and approached through a barrier, a curtain, a veil, or door. In Solomon's temple, the debir would have held the Ark of the Covenant, topped by the mercy seat, on which God, and sometimes the king, sat, though in the second temple, Zerubbabel's and Herod's, the space was empty. The aedicule at Dura framed or enclosed what is variously called the Torah shrine, or the Torah niche, or the house of the Ark. According to Goodenough, where the scrolls are, there is the Shekinah, or the presence of God in all reality. The Torah niche was similar to the entry from the domestic spaces into the forecourt, four steps up. The fourth step, however, was considerably higher than the other three. The fourth step became the niche's floor. Goodenough writes that the aron, or box, that held the scrolls, was laid upon this higher level by men who themselves only ascended the first three steps. The space extended into the wall's thickness in a semicircle, forming a shape not unlike a small elevated apse that was, when finished, 16 inches deep. Both Kraling and Goodenough agree this sort of fixed Torah shrine was not known before Dura. Since the aedicule seems to have extended into the hall of assembly 16 inches or so, the enclosed space was a total of 32 inches deep or a bit more, and therefore roughly square. Kraling reports evidence that the aedicule was further extended into the House of Assembly and covered by an ornamental and protective covering, a baldachin of the type mentioned in rabbinical sources, which would have supported two curtains before the aedicule. Clearly the Torah shrine had an overall ornamental and protective covering that completed it at the top. Both Kraling and Goodenough portray the aedicule as covered by veils or curtains. Worshippers first saw the aedicule from 25 feet away, as it was almost directly across the House of Assembly from the massive entry doors. When the synagogue was unearthed in the early 20th century, the proposed and more perishable baldachin and curtains were absent, as was whatever structure had been anchored in the synagogue's walls to support the baldachin or curtains. The excavators looked directly into the aedicule and the Torah shrine, which most at Dura would not have seen. The shrine itself resembled an elevated seat about 16 inches deep and 33 inches wide. Above it was an elaborate scalloped shell, heavily imposed upon the semi-dome, rather than structurally integrated with the surface and the painted light blue and dark green. Above it was an elaborate scalloped shell, heavily imposed upon the semi-dome, rather than structurally integrated with the surface and painted light blue and dark green. The shell symbol was widely used above sacred objects of all kinds to indicate the divine character of the object under it. If the Torah shrine can be seen as a separate and elevated space, then the enclosed space could be called a debir, If so, we are justified in considering the Hebrew words for temple spaces in addition to the Greek and Latin vocabulary. It is possible the synagogue referred to the tabernacle in the wilderness and the successive temples in Jerusalem, not just in its frescoes, but also in its layout, orientation, focus, and perhaps some of its functions. These gamma marks, multiple occurrence, connect the synagogue at Dura with the wider strains of Judaism in ways that were apparently not documented in Jewish literature, but may have influenced the design of the synagogue. It is possible the worshippers at Dura may have drawn on earlier Israelite temples and on rituals they associated with them as they designed and built the Bet, the house. The Anointing of David panel at Dura and the discovery of Gamma Mark textiles at Dura may indicate simply an Eastern peculiarity, or they may hold clues to the Gamma's meaning in the Jewish context. Summary and conclusion. Physical artifacts illuminate cultures in ways their written records cannot, and in ways their monuments and fine arts do not. They give insights into the lives of that majority who could not produce documents nor commission art. Textiles can be especially illuminating. Maciej Szymaszek's study of the tapestry-woven Gamma Mark textiles from late antiquity reveal their widespread and relatively consistent use by both genders in a variety of social classes, in multiple cultures and religious contexts, and across great distances. They add to what gamma-marked monuments and art may show. The evidence Szymaszek collected shows that, at least in some cases, the marked mantles were not imported luxury goods, but rather were domestically produced and used by humbler classes of people. In some cases, they were associated with death and burial. The textiles, when taken with written evidence from the Liber Pontificalis, the monuments and the arts suggest the marks sometimes delineated boundaries or levels of sacredness. They may have sometimes been associated with rites of passage or other rituals. In the Jewish context, the textiles and the monumental art show the marks' use for more than four centuries in late antiquity at multiple sites across the region. They link the textiles found at Dura Europus and portrayed in the Anointing of David panel with other Jewish contexts and invite a reconsideration of the influences on the Dura synagogue. This has been a recording of Gamma Mark's Recent Works Relevant to Their Study by Janet Ewell, published in Interpreter, a Journal of Latter-day Saint Faith and Scholarship, Volume 68, 2026, read by Janet Ewell. This audio recording is copyrighted under a Creative Commons license and may be freely distributed if it remains unchanged, the journal and the website are credited, and is for non-commercial use. A printed version of this and many more articles can be found at journal.interpreterfoundation.org. More information about the Interpreter Foundation, along with a wide array of additional resources, can be found at interpreterfoundation.org.